On page after page, as I read McGrath, I found myself scribbling teapot in the margin. Again invoking T.H. Huxley, McGrath says,
"Fed up with both theists and atheists making hopelessly dogmatic statements on the basis of inadequate empirical evidence, Huxley declared that the God question could not be settled on the basis of the scientific method."
McGrath goes on to quote Stephen Jay Gould in similar vein.
"To say it for all my colleagues and for the umpteenth millionth time, from college bull sessions to learned treatises, science simply cannot, by its legitimate methods, adjudicate the issue of God's possible superintendence of nature. We neither affirm nor deny it. We simply can't comment on it as scientists."
Despite the confident, almost bullying tone of Gould's assertion, what actually is the justification for it? Why shouldn't we comment on God as scientists? And why isn't Russell's teapot or the flying spaghetti monster equally immune from scientific scepticism? As I shall argue in a moment, a universe with a creative superintendent would be a very different kind of universe from one without. Why is that not a scientific matter? Gould carried the art of bending over backwards to positively supine lengths in one of his less admired books, Rocks of Ages. There he coined the acronym NOMA for the phrase non-overlapping magisteria.
"The net or magisterium of science covers the empirical realm. What is the universe made of? Fact. And why does it work this way? Theory. The magisterium of religion extends over questions of ultimate meaning and moral value. These two magisteria do not overlap, nor do they encompass all inquiry. Consider, for example, the magisterium of art and the meaning of beauty. To cite the old clichés, science gets the age of rocks and religion the rock of ages. Science studies how the heavens go, religion how to go to heaven."
This sounds terrific, right up until you give it a moment's thought. What are these ultimate questions in whose presence religion is an honoured guest and science must respectfully slink away? Martin Rees, the distinguished Cambridge astronomer whom I've already mentioned, begins his book Our Cosmic Habitat by posing two candidate ultimate questions and giving a NOMA-friendly answer.
"The preeminent mystery is why anything exists at all. What breathes life into the equations and actualized them in a real cosmos? Such questions lie beyond science, however. They are the province of philosophers and theologians."
I would prefer to say that if indeed they lie beyond science, they most certainly lie beyond the province of theologians as well. I doubt that philosophers would thank Martin Rees for lumping theologians in with them. I am tempted to go further and wonder in what possible sense theologians can be said to have a province. I am still amused when I recall the remark of a former warden head of my Oxford college. A young theologian had applied for a junior research fellowship, and his doctoral thesis on Christian theology provoked the warden to say,
"I have grave doubts as to whether it's a subject at all."
What expertise can theologians bring to deep cosmological questions that scientists cannot? In another book, I recounted the words of an Oxford astronomer who, when I asked him one of those same deep questions, said,
"Ah, now we move beyond the realm of science. This is where I have to hand over to our good friend the chaplain."
I was not quick-witted enough to utter the response that I later wrote, "But why the chaplain? Why not the gardener or the chef?" Why are scientists so cravenly respectful towards the ambitions of theologians over questions that theologians are certainly no more qualified to answer than scientists themselves? It is a tedious cliché, and unlike many clichés it isn't even true, that science concerns itself with how questions, but only theology is equipped to answer why questions. What on earth is a why question? Not every English sentence beginning with the word why is a legitimate question. Why are unicorns hollow? Some questions simply do not deserve an answer. What is the colour of abstraction? What is the smell of hope? The fact that a question can be phrased in a grammatically correct English sentence doesn't make it meaningful or entitle it to our serious attention. Nor, even if the question is a real one, does the fact that science cannot answer it imply that religion can. Perhaps there are some genuinely profound and meaningful questions that are forever beyond the reach of science.